y'all. This is Connie Morgan with the Free Black Thought Podcast. Today's episode features a very special guest, at least in terms of my personal interests. I had the privilege and pleasure of interviewing Dr. Angel Adams Parham. She's a co-author of The Black Intellectual Tradition, Reading Freedom in Classical Literature, and co-founder and executive director of Nyan Sa Classical Community. If you listen to this podcast with regularity, you have probably heard me mention her book to someone in a previous episode, as I have done so on more than one occasion. Angel is an associate professor of sociology and a senior fellow for advanced studies in culture at the University of Virginia, and her work in classical education is all about connecting students with diverse backgrounds to the great conversation. That is, to cultivate moral imagination and guide them on the pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty, an endeavor I am so down with. The classical tradition is not just about old white men, though we do love many of our classical white kings, and anyone that tells you a classical education is only for white people is just ignorant. We know there is no such thing as the black perspective, just black people with perspectives, many of which are enduring and timeless.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.
Angel, welcome to the Free Black Thought Podcast, and thank you so much for joining me today. You were one of the first people that we put on our list when we had this podcast. When we started this podcast, we were like, we will have Angel on the podcast at some point, and it's been a long time coming. I'm just very excited for this topic. And talking about your book, The Black Intellectual Tradition, Reading Freedom in Classical Literature, will kind of be our cornerstone for this conversation. But before we get into all of that, please tell our audience where you were raised, how you grew up, and kind of tell us the short and skinny on your autobiography.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I've been around for a while, so goodness. Okay, so I guess the easiest entree is that I grew up in Miami, Florida, and grew up in I grew up in two parts of Miami. So it's not Miami proper. It's pretty far south, Homestead, Florida. And it's not what comes to mind when people think of Miami. You know, it was a pretty modest, not at all glamorous. People always assume I grew up going to the beach. I went to the beach a handful of times. And then when I was older, we moved a little further to downtown Miami, but not much further. So it was pretty standard suburban type, I would have said boring upbringing, but you know, sometimes boring is good. There, you know, weren't any extraordinary things happening. But I went to great schools, really wonderful schools. So we used the public school system, the magnet system, so that I could go to some of the best schools. And then I went away to college.
Did you have siblings, two-parent household? What was that like?
Yeah, sure. So one sibling, one younger sister, parents separated and then divorced when I was six. Okay. And so that's actually when we moved to Miami, because we had been in Maryland. And then my mother had grown up, or she was a military child, but she had spent the last part of high school in Florida, and that's where her parents were.
Okay.
And so she took me and my sister down to Miami. And so I grew up there since I was 6 years old. So that's really kind of my primary growing up years happened there.
Okay. Okay. So sorry to interrupt. Then you went off to college.
Then I went off to college. I went to Yale, which was great, you know, which was very different. So now, people often do a lot, you know, in their preparation to get to the Ivy League. And for me, you know, I was always an excellent, excellent student, play the cello and, you know, still play the cello. And so, you know, there was kind of a music angle to it, but I had no thoughts of applying to an Ivy League school. Mm-hmm. It was teachers who encouraged me to do it. And so it was really teachers in my high school who believed in me, saw something in me, and encouraged me to apply. And I got in, and it was very exciting.
Was Yale the only school that you applied to in the Ivy Leagues, or did you apply to a bunch of them?
I also applied to Harvard and was rejected. Oh, well, too bad for Harvard, you know, but I got into all the other colleges that I applied to.
Okay.
And decided to go to Yale. So yeah, you know, but it was, I had a plan to go to college, but I hadn't really thought about an Ivy League college.
Okay.
And when I got to college, though, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, these are my people, you know, because I was the kind of, you know, somewhat isolated high school student. Like, I just wasn't a typical student. I loved to read. I loved playing the cello. I've volunteered at the hospital on Friday nights.
Oh my gosh.
because I wanted to, Connie, not because there were no service hours required. I just had this romantic notion of the candy striper and I was going to just do this great work and I loved it. And mm-hmm. so every Friday night in high school, I was a candy striper and, you know, played classical music and read and loved Victorian novels, you know, loved Emily Dickinson and got me through high school because she was also this lone woman, you know, on her own, but having these amazing thoughts and writing this brilliant poetry. So you can probably kind of see how the public high school scene was not
I mean,
very, very
honestly, you're the ideal child, I think, for a lot of people. Like, I want a kid like that to just volunteers, plays the cello and reads her books.
But it did not make for an overly happy high school experience. You know, I was just some kind of weirdo. So when I got to college, like I just found a lot of people like that and they didn't think I was a weirdo and, right. you know, had great conversations. And so it was really refreshing. And I just felt like, you know, there was an adjustment period, you know, and I think probably a lot of students, you know, who go to highly competitive colleges, you know, you're used to being at the top with little effort and then you get there and all those people are there.
Right, right.
And now it's like, oh, wow, I might have to step up my game a little bit. But, you know, I figured that out and did well and really enjoyed the time.
So did you know what you wanted to major in? I mean, actually, it sounded like you had maybe interest in medicine, but that's not where you're at now.
No, I didn't have an interest in medicine. I just had an interest in being a candy striper.
Okay.
So no interest in being in medicine. I wanted to be an English professor and I was absolutely certain, you know, I took the APs in high school. I loved English literature. Like I said, Victorian novels, you know, kind of reading Gothic novels for fun was, you know, what I did. Mm-hmm. So I went off to college absolutely certain I would be an English professor and talked my way into the upper level classes as a freshman.
Oh, wow.
Started taking Latin. I wanted to learn Chaucer's English. You know, I'd had a high school teacher come into our class when we were about to start Chaucer, and he made this dramatic late entrance. Because he was never late, you know, so we're all sitting there wondering, so what's going on? You know, why, where is he? And then he sweeps into the room. He just says nothing to us. He doesn't greet us. He just starts off. One that April with his sure sota, the drought of March hath passed to the rota, and drowned a ravine in sweet liqueur of which vertu and ginger is the fleur. And I was done. I was like, that is what I want in my life is Chaucer and like more of this right here. Mm-hmm. So that is what that's what I went to college expecting to do. And so, you know, I took all these advanced courses and started taking Latin. I think I took a course on Chaucer, if I'm not mistaken. Well, it just didn't go that way. So the Latin class apparently was filled with people who had been taking Latin at fancy prep schools for years. And even though it was the 101 class, I was the only, you know, crazy person who had never had Latin. And the graduate student teaching it was teaching at the level of the people who already basically knew Latin.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have any context for understanding, really. I was just like, wow, I guess I'm just not meant for this. And then, so I was taking the Victorian novel, the professor teaching the lecture was outstanding. It was a great class. But then the discussion section, you know, where you have the discussion section breakout usually with the graduate student teaching assistants. So things started to get a little odd because she would bring in these weird, like kind of social theory and psychoanalytic theory readings of the literature that for me and my 18 or 19 year old brain just didn't make sense. I just thought, why are we bringing strange theories into these novels? Like, why can't we just read them and and analyze them, yes, mm-hmm. You know, put them in some kind of historical and social context. But like, these were interpretations that I felt were weirdly stretched. And so I thought to myself, I know I want to be a professor. I know I'm going to have to write a dissertation. Do I want to spend my life applying arcane social and psychoanalytic theories to literature? And my answer was no.
Do you have any examples of one of those?
I do. Examples? Okay. Yes, I do. The one that I was just like, this is not going to be my life. We were reading Dickens. I think it was Great Expectations. And so young Pip, I guess we can check to see if that's Pip in Great Expectations or not. Young Pip was sitting at a table and shaking his leg. And I don't remember the rest of the scene. I haven't gone back to look at it in all these years. And so the teaching assistant, she has this gleam in her eye. You know, she's so excited. She's like, so what do we see here? What's going on? And so, you know, I'm like, I don't know. He's sitting at the table. He's shaking his leg. She said, yeah, this seems like a very, you know, kind of Freudian moment of what's going on here. And so she wanted to do this really deep psychoanalytic theory as to why he was shaking his leg while he was sitting at the table. Mm. And I just thought, why can't a boy just be a boy sitting at a table shaking his leg? Like, why do we need to bring Freud into this? It just seemed odd to me. And so, you know, I think if I had had, you know, and I don't want to get, you know, English academics upset at me. I think if I'd had, you know, maybe a different perspective or a mentor or, you know, someone who could help me make sense of it and say, well, you know, maybe this is how this person's going to develop as a scholar, but you might develop into a different kind of scholar and do something different, I might have stuck with it, but I didn't, you know. And so I just said, I don't think I want to do this. And I was reading Middlemarch. I remember it very, very clearly. I was sitting in the library reading Middlemarch for a class. And I thought to myself, you know, I still love literature. I said, what I really love as I'm sitting here reading this novel is I love, you know, kind of getting into a society and a culture and just understanding it. You know, like this is a completely different century. It's a different place. It's almost like a foreign country. I just love understanding it and, you know, thinking about what, you know, why people do what they do and, you know, what this society and culture is like. And I had some vague notion of sociology and I said, oh, you know, I think they study people and cultures and I won't have to make things up. You know, I'll do like study society as it is. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to go over there and I've been there ever since. So I say all that to say, you know, these were the thoughts of an 18-year-old. It's not like I had incredibly sophisticated analyses of academia or disciplines, but there it is.
And so when did you actually start hearing the phrase or the term classical education? Like, when did that enter your, you mean you were getting a classical education kind of the whole time, but when did you actually mm-hmm. understand that that's what that was and that's what you loved?
Yeah, so I'd say I was until I switched to sociology, and then it really wasn't a classical education because I dropped the Latin, you know, I stopped the English. I didn't hear anything like classical education until I had my daughters and I was making a decision about how to educate them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really start kind of re-educating myself classically until about a decade ago when I was homeschooling them. So it's been a relatively recent thing.
So did that experience in that class put kind of such a bad taste in your mouth that you almost just, were you not reading the types of literature that you were reading before after that? It totally just turned you off, or were you still kind of doing it as a hobby or, you know, as your passion?
So I never stopped reading. You know, I've always been a reader. I've always loved literature. But at the time, so I thought, well, maybe I could do a minor in English, right? But Yale, for whatever reason, did not have the option of a minor. And so it was either two majors or nothing. And at least at that time, every student, and I think I'm remembering this is what I remember, is everyone had to write a senior thesis. And so I wasn't really keen to have two full majors and two senior theses.
Right.
And I suppose I could have just kept taking lots of English and kind of, you know, had an informal concentration, but I just didn't think that way. And so I was like, well, you know, I can't minor in it and I don't want to have a second major. So I'll just focus on sociology and, you know, just kind of read in my spare time.
Okay. So you didn't start entering the classical education world till you had your own kids. In between, now you're a sociology major. What were you doing? What was your career like in that in between college and kids?
Yeah. So it was a pretty straightforward training in sociology. So got my bachelor's degree, did, you know, I really did enjoy, you know, doing social research. So in college, for instance, I took a qualitative field methods course. And, you know, that's where you go out in the community and you kind of do research and try to, you know, try to understand the social world. So what did I decide to do for that project? I found a really fascinating group that was dedicated to bringing young people out of gangs.
Okay.
And so this is New Haven in the 90s. It was not like the New Haven of today. It was very, very much a stark separation between this highly elite, super resource institution and a largely Black and poor city. And so there were a lot of tensions between the campus and the community. I remember being called by some, you know, Black people in the New Haven community, you know, basically a traitor, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, a sellout because I was going to Yale. Yeah. So anyway, I don't know how I found this organization, but it was led by an ex-gang member. And he was doing this really great work in the community, bringing young people out of gangs and keeping them or preventing them from going in. And I have always been, you know, the kind of Black person who's on the margins of the Black community. You know, it kind of the whole reason that you founded and are doing this podcast, you know, resonates very much with me because that's just always been my reality. Yeah. So there was a way in which I could use doing sociology as a way to try to understand parts of the Black community that, you know, were foreign to me. And I thought the work was really good. And so I actually went and started doing participant observation with this group, going to their meetings, you know, talking to people when they were going to protest, going with them, kind of doing informal interviews and conversations, and wrote up a paper on it. You know, so for me, this was a way of kind of being a social researcher gave me entree to parts of the community that, you know, I didn't belong to, but allowed me to kind of try to understand them. So, you know, it's not English, but it's fascinating. I'm yeah. learning a lot. I'm trying to get to understand people, and then decided that, you know, I still wanted to be a professor. And so I then applied for a Fulbright grant and got a Fulbright to study for a year in Tanzania. And so I took Swahili my last year in college. This is before the internet is really the internet. You know, people were just starting to send email. You see how old I am. and I did not get into email when I was in college. So in order for me to do all the paperwork for this Fulbright, I had to send a snail mail letter to Tanzania.
Wow.
And write to a professor there and describe my research project and then wait to receive a snail mail letter back to then send it all snail mail to DC for my application. So that gives you a sense of kind of like what it was like. Mm-hmm. But so anyway, I got it and I basically just got on the plane and landed in Dar es Salaam. And all I had was that one letter exchange. You know, there weren't any phone calls. There was no email. Wow. It's just come on over. And I just flew on over there.
Wow.
So, and landed with a working knowledge of Swahili from the really great training I had. And yeah, that was it. The first email I sent was from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania to apply to grad school. So I applied to grad school from Tanzania. Didn't get to visit anywhere, you know, made all my applications through DHL and decided on Wisconsin out of all the places I had gotten into. And then once I got there, had to decide, was I going to keep working on Tanzania and East Africa, or was I going to change? I decided I did not want a life of flying halfway across the world, but I still wanted to work in the African diaspora. Mm-hmm. And so having grown up in Miami, I had a cognizance of the Haitian community, and thought, yeah, this could be interesting. And I saw an opportunity to do a short-term travel trip about 10 days to Haiti with a group. And so I flew down there with this group, and I just loved it. I just loved it. I had already spent 2 years operating in Swahili, and I knew I started taking a little French because I knew I was going to go to Haiti. I got to Haiti, heard Haitian Creole, which is closely related to French, and thought to myself, you know, this resonates with me. You know, I've known French and Creole for much less time than I've known Swahili, but it just, I mean, they're, you know, the cognates of the language because it's a romance language. Yeah. And there are so many, there are more cognates with English in Creole than there are in Swahili, right? And so it just, I felt at home linguistically, beautiful place, even though, you know, very troubled. And I just loved it. And I started picking up Creole pretty quickly. And so switched my work to do work on Haiti in grad school.
Okay. And then where did you go from there? What was the next step? You're loving the Haitian stuff. And then what came next?
So I write my dissertation, and it's on the Haitian immigrant community. And then my first job out of grad school is in New Orleans. So I go down to New Orleans, which I ended up living in for 18 years. I had never been there before the interview, and I was absolutely, you know, flabbergasted because I mean, it just the look and feel of New Orleans. I don't know if you've been there, but the architecture is completely different. So it's much more kind of Spanish and French Creole architecture. It many people will say it doesn't look American, which is true. Like it's got a completely different aesthetic. History, its African diaspora history is completely different than the Anglophone majority. So I thought it was amazing. And then I was talking to my new chair and he said, you know, you do all this work on Haiti. New Orleans has such a deep history with Haiti. You should really look into that. And that was something that, you know, I guess I'm sure I knew somehow about, you know, the Louisiana Purchase and the Haitian Revolution being central to Napoleon selling this big parcel of Louisiana to the U.S., but I hadn't really thought about it. And it ended up really very much shaping all so much of my scholarly work because my first book was looking at the descendants of the Haitian Revolution who came to New Orleans, both Black and white. And I did a comparison of them over 200 years. And so looking at those cultural ties between Haiti and New Orleans, continuing to use French and Creole, traveling to Haiti, just being steeped in the awesome culture of New Orleans is what I did for those 18 years. And it was there that I had, when I had my kids and was trying to decide, okay, now how am I going to educate them? So I'm a professor, I'm doing this work, I'm living in New Orleans, I'm loving it. And then it comes time to think about what am I going to do for my daughters? Mm-hmm. And that's when things started to really take a turn toward where I am right now.
So when you had your daughters and you're thinking about how you want to educate them, were you thinking of homeschooling right from the jump? Like I'm always interested in people who have older grown children who are Black and homeschool because, or even thinking about homeschool back then, because it just wasn't a thing that a lot of Black people were doing. So can you just take us through your thought process of your you're weighing all your options? What was that like?
Yeah. So this is New Orleans. I should say I was there. Well, I wasn't physically there, but Hurricane Katrina hit while I was in New Orleans because I was there starting in 2003. We had evacuated, like most of the city, but post Katrina, you know, everyone's trying to get everything back on track, you know, but the education system, even pre-Katrina, had been pretty notoriously, I would say even infamously, troubled. And so post-Katrina, there was a massive effort to really overhaul and reform the schools. And so the way of doing that was to turn it into an all-charter system. So anyway, I'm having trying to decide what I'm going to do with my daughters, and we're just a few years post-Katrina. And I am thinking about all that I had read about the school system in the last few years, and I'm thinking, this is not looking very promising. I don't know. I am extremely demanding when it comes to education and the education of my children. I wanted to be excellent. And so I did start thinking about homeschooling. Really wasn't excited about, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for private school. Yeah. And I had heard of people who had homeschooled. And so what I decided to do is I told my husband, I said, you know, I have some flexibility in when I schedule my teaching. And I think this is something we should experiment with. So when my oldest was 4 years old, I said, you know, I'm going to pull her out of the daycare and I'm going to bring her home and her one-year-old sister home. And I figured I couldn't mess up pre-K-4 too badly.
Yeah.
So I got a homeschool curriculum. And actually, incidentally, and this is the other thing I should say, is even before I made that decision, I had started with a homeschool curriculum when my oldest was 2 years old. And so before I had any inkling of doing homeschooling full time, I wanted to work with them at home. Yeah. And I found a 2-year-old curriculum and a 3-year-old curriculum, very basic, and just 20 minutes a day. Every day before I took her to daycare, I would do this curriculum. And she was just learning by leaps and bounds. And one day I came in to pick her up, and the teacher in the 3-year-old room said, she came to me, her eyes were really bright. She's like, oh my goodness, did you know your daughter knows all of her letters? And I said, why, yes, I do. But I was a little concerned at how surprised she was, because I thought, why is this so extraordinary? Because I had been working with her for almost 2 years mm-hmm. with this curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so when I asked them their educational philosophy, because I was trying to make this decision about pre-K-4, they said, well, you know, we believe in learning through play. I was like, okay, great. But it only took me 20 minutes a day, you know, for her to be counting, you know, number recognition, letter sounds. And since she's already done that, and you're clearly not doing that, even in the 3-year-old room, what is she going to be learning in pre-K-4? You know, it seems like she's kind of learned a lot of what you're probably even going to just start teaching her. And so I felt like I had no problems with learning through play, but it seemed like we were on very different, we were in very different places in terms of educational philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so that just cemented my sense that I should go ahead and bring her home. Now, people always ask, because I did the homeschooling for about a decade while I was working full time. And they say, gosh, how could you do that? So the reason is that I had a very short commute by bicycle to work.
Okay.
15 to 18 minute commute on my bike. I've always made a little deliberate effort to try to bike or walk to work. It's just made my life so much happier than relying on a car. And so when you have a 15-minute commute, you're never going to run into traffic on a bike.
Right.
It's extremely reliable. It makes you a much happier person. And so I knew that my commute, it was reliable and short. If you think about it, your average person who has a car commute or even a train commute, it's going to be quite a bit. You know, people routinely have commutes of 45 minutes, an hour, longer than an hour one way. So when people are surprised that I could homeschool, I would bring to their attention that my round trip commute was 30 to 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Round trip. Mm-hmm. And so just think about all the time the average person spends in their car or on a train commuting. That was the time the time that they were doing that is the time I was homeschooling my daughters.
Yeah.
So I would do the initial lessons, teaching them all the new material, having kind of common reading time with them together. We're Christians, so we would also pray together and read scripture. So all of that would happen within about, it would take me about 2.5 hours in the morning. Mm-hmm. And then I would leave, and I would leave a long list of, okay, they've had, you know, these lessons, and here's what I expect them to work on while I'm gone. And so my husband's a freelancer. If he was in between jobs, he would stay with them, mm-hmm. and he would supervise and make sure. So he didn't have to teach them. He just had to, you know, make sure that they were getting done what I had left.
Yeah.
And if he was on a job, then we would hire someone to come in mm-hmm. and do the same thing.
Okay.
And so that's how we managed. And I got into classical homeschooling. I was introduced by another African-American homeschooler who was leading, she was leading a classical Christian homeschool group. And she invited me to an open house. And my girls were 4 and 7 years old. And I was so, so impressed by what they were doing. And I said, this, I definitely want this for my daughters. And so that really brought us on the journey toward classical education.
Was that group that you joined, were they like a one-off independent group, or were they a part of like Classical Conversations or something like that?
It was Classical Conversations.
Can you tell the audience? I know what that is, but can you tell our audience what it is?
Sure. Yeah. So Classical Conversations is, it may be the largest homeschool classical group.
I'm not sure. I feel like it has to be, but.
Yeah, I would think so. So what they do basically is they make it very, very doable to do classical, they're classical and Christian homeschoolers. And so the model is that you go there once a week and basically spend much of the day there. When the children are 4 years old up until the end of sixth grade, the parent has to stay on site with the child, and you have basically kind of a community day. All of the work that you've been doing all week, memorization work, writing work, they would present every single week. They'd have like a presentation they'd have to put together so they'd learn how to speak well. All of that work you do at home, you then kind of work on it, showcase it, share it with others on the community day. And so that is, it gives you a structure and some accountability, which was really helpful for me, especially since I was working full time. It was very helpful to know that there's this kind of accountability. Have they gotten this done? Like, here's what everyone else is working on. So that's how it is through the end of sixth grade. And then once they hit seventh grade, seventh through 12th grade, they go for their community day, but you just drop them off. And they're working with a parent who's a tutor who, you know, kind of basically runs seminar with them on everything that they've been reading. They're studying Latin. And the thing that I saw when I went to the Classical Conversations open house that really impressed me was the memory work. And people are often very down on memorization, but I say, you know, it depends on how you do it. And also I defy anyone to, you know, how do you really get good at math if you don't know any math facts, right? You have to have some memorization. But the memorization that they do at Classical Conversations is very much through songs mm-hmm. and chants. Mm-hmm. And kids love it.
Yeah.
So one of the things I saw there was the timeline song. And the timeline song is amazing. It's about 12 minutes long. And the children sing history from early human history all the way to the 21st century. And it's got, you know, there's a teacher's manual that has every, you know, kind of piece of that timeline song and every instance of history that's recorded in it. But they have hand motions and it's catchy. Mm-hmm. They love singing it. And then what you do is you kind of put together, like I would put together readings like history, historical fiction, you know, it when we were focusing on different time periods. Mm-hmm. And so they just had a whole really extensive memory work section with songs and, you know, recommended readings to study and go along with it. And so that was what really sold me. It's like, this is an amazing amount of information. You're never going to forget that timeline song. Mm-hmm. And then you're basically using that as kind of a peg on which to hang the deeper learning that's going to happen. So that's what I loved about it.
And how do you define a classical education now? How do you know if someone's kid's in a school or in a co-op or in a whatever, it might not be classical conversations. It might not be a school specifically branded as a classical education. But even if they are, how do you know whether that's true or not? Like, what are the tenets of a classical education?
Right. So I'd say there may be, I have three things I would look for. So one is I would look for an approach to education that is cultivating wonder, wisdom, and virtue, right? You know, is that a self-conscious part of the way they're thinking about the education? Because there are, I don't think that's the major way we think about education today, right? We think of it as very practically oriented, professionally oriented, right? So I look for, is your philosophy of why you're doing this education, the cultivation of wisdom, wonder, and virtue, right? That you want to, you know, help to cultivate a really beautiful human being, you know, who is, yes, we hope they're going to get a good job. Looking at my bank balance, I really hope they get a good job sometime soon, because like the paying for the tuition is serious. So yes, I want them to get a good job, but you know, being educated is not just about getting a job. It's so much more about cultivating a beautiful human being. So that's what I look for. That's one thing. Next, I'm looking for content. And so it's about reading great books and texts, studying great literature, music, art. I'm looking for texts that have stood the test of time and that helped cultivate this wonder, wisdom, and virtue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is where many people get upset with classical education because they feel like it's not going to have enough diverse authors. Of course, I, you know, have spent a lot of time saying that doesn't have to be true, right? That it's quite possible. I mean, you know, that's like saying there haven't been any non-white authors who have had enduring ideas, right? You know, or who's like, right? That's not true. So there are. So I'm looking for excellent content that has stood the test of time and that is really delving deeply into these questions of, you know, what it means to be human, wisdom, virtue, and so on. And the third thing that I look for is the pedagogy. So like I said, memorization, right? At one point, I wondered if I was going to be able to keep doing the whole homeschool and working full time. And I toured a private school that many of my colleagues sent their girls to. It was an all-girls school. And what was interesting as I was on the tours, I found that they were doing several things there that I was doing at home, mm-hmm. which was very affirming. Yeah. But then I asked about math and memorization. And what I got was an apologetic, well, sometimes we do memorization, but we try not to do too much of it.
Like they thought it was a bad thing to tell you.
They yeah. thought it was a bad thing. Yeah. And I'm thinking, what is going on? This doesn't make any sense. Of course you need to. You need to have your math facts. I mean, I drilled my girls on math facts back and forward. You know, the timeline song is about memorizing history. Like you just need to have certain facts down cold, right? So that part of the pedagogy is important. But then there are other things like, say, copy work. And so copy work is where it brings together, you know, kind of having children meditate on what is good, beautiful, and true, and working on, you know, kind of some of the basic learned academic skills. So you might have them copying Bible verses or, you know, other kind of good literature, just a sentence, and it allows them to practice their handwriting, but also be thinking about good things and good literature. There's cursive writing. Is very, very important. It's really a shame it's been given up. A lot of the scholarly work I do is actually historical, looking at 18th and 19th century documents. And I defy anyone to do historical work and not know cursive. You have to at least know how to read it.
Right.
In fact, I have found I've got a wonderful research assistant now, and she knows cursive. She has no problem with it. But she says that the other graduate students that she knows who are doing degrees in history don't know how to read cursive, right? Like, it's wow. Okay, so that's one. And then there are other pedagogies that come along with classical education that I could talk about forever, but I don't want to bore you and your listeners. But those are the things I look for, is the kind of the philosophy of, what's your philosophy of education in terms of wonder, wisdom, and virtue, the content, the enduring text that are going to help in cultivating, hopefully, a young person with a beautiful soul and a beautiful life, and then the pedagogies.
Yes, and all of this, all of these questions are leading up to talk about kind of your efforts to, you know, actually basically walk the walk and talk the talk. You're like, hey, there are diverse authors and not just in literature, but, you know, music, art, etc. Classical education is not just a dead white man thing. And you've written this wonderful book, The Black Intellectual Tradition, Reading Freedom in Classical Literature. You've also developed a curriculum. And I have mentioned this book on at least two other podcasts that I've recorded. It truly is wonderful. And I think anybody who's listening to this and is considering, actually, I'm going to say this, every parent is a home educator. Whether you consider yourself or not, you are educating your kids at home.
Yes.
This is a book that I think every parent should read. Certainly if you're going to homeschool, I don't care if you're Black, white, Asian, whatever. The Black Intellectual Tradition is so good. And did you create this because, did you write this book along with, you co-wrote it with Anika Prather, did you do it because people kept coming to you and saying, classical education is so white, or was it all just internal? You were kind of searching for adding more diversity into your children's, book list. And so then you're like, hey, I've already done kind of started the work. Let's just, you know, expound upon it. What led you to actually step into, I mean, I would consider you're a part of the classical education, you know, corner of the world now with these books and with these curriculum. What made you actually take the leap, so to speak, and write these books and create this curriculum?
Yeah. So it was really the experience of the way I came into classical education. Like I said, I was introduced to it by another Black woman who is a home educator. And so we would always talk about, you know, wow, you know, it's, you know, the curricula can sometimes be very, you know, kind of Eurocentric, and you don't see those other authors. And we would just wonder about that. It's like, why is that? Mm-hmm. And that's not how we would educate our kids. You know, we would weave in lots of different voices. And then I started doing some background reading and just, you know, kind of, I already knew about Du Bois because he's very big amongst sociologists, but what I hadn't really considered was how classically educated he was and how much you just see that throughout all of his writing. And other Black writers, especially of the 19th century, but also the 18th century, who had been very classically educated, and you see this coming out in their writing and their thinking. And so just over the years, you know, I had been kind of sitting back and looking at classical education. And because I was educating at home, I would use the mainstream resources, which were not very diverse. Mm-hmm. And then I would add to them.
Yes.
And then my friend and I, her name is Danielle Bennett Dukes. She's the one who introduced me to classical education. And she's the one with whom I co-founded Nyansa Classical Community, which was meant to bring this kind of education to a community that was unlikely to get it. So predominantly African-American students and often from under-resourced communities. And the reason that I wanted to do that is because this whole time that I'm educating my daughters living in New Orleans, we lived in an inner city community in New Orleans. And we lived there on purpose. It was a larger vision of the church that we were part of that had different properties in this community, and the church was there. And so I would be educating my girls, you know, we're reading all of these great texts. And then I go outside across the street, and other mothers, you know, we had kids about the same age. And they say, wow, you know, your kids seem to be doing really well. And like, we're just having all these issues. You know, my son's not learning how to read. You know, I'm sending him to school, but it's just not working. Mm-hmm. Do you have any resources? And so, Danielle, you know, also really has a heart for kids who are not getting the kind of education they should be getting. And so that was really the impetus for us to co-found Nyansa Classical Community, which was to bring this classical education to students who were not going to be getting it any other way, mm-hmm. and to bring it where they were living, but to weave together the traditions, right? Like there's no particular reason that it has to look one way. And when, especially in the Black intellectual tradition, the Black community, we have such a history of blending together cultures and traditions and making something really beautiful. And so we wanted to bring that to the students. Mm-hmm. So as it happened, you know, I was doing that work for a few years, running it as an after-school program, and we didn't have a written curricula at all. Mm-hmm. So I would just kind of come every time we were meeting, and I had a host of college students doing service learning with me who really made it happen. And I'd say, this is what we're reading. This is what we're doing today, you know, kind of break up into the groups. And so it was very kind of, you know, like kind of seat of the pants, you know, trying to figure out what we're going to do the next meeting. Mm-hmm. So that started to change for a couple of reasons. One is that I started to get tired. It's like, I don't know, homeschooling, working full time, and running a nonprofit and being on site. Like, I was like, I'm not sure how long I can do this. And then COVID, which made it impossible to do anything. So between the two of those, I said, I need to write this up as a curriculum that is a plug and play, you know, anyone can do it. And I can train other people to create programs. Yeah. And so we moved in that direction. I hired curriculum writers. I told them, this is how we did it. You know, here were all of our best practices. Here's the template. And that's what we've been doing ever since. So I then went to some meetings of the Society for Classical Learning used to have an urban educators retreat that it preceded their national conference. And it was for people who were doing classical education amongst under-resourced communities, a lot of minority communities. And so I went to a couple of those and, you know, people learned about what we were doing in New Orleans, learned about what I was doing, and a representative from the publisher that published our book was there and said, hey, this is really interesting. You know, we don't have a lot of voices, you know, who are saying this and kind of putting these resources together. Would you be interested in putting together? They have something called Classical U at Classical Academic Press. And it's an extraordinary resource. So anyone interested in any aspect of classical education, if you go to Classical U, they have these short courses with pre-recorded lectures and discussion questions on so many different, you know, dozens of topics. And they said, we'd love for you to do a Classical U course on the Black intellectual tradition and the classics. And at the same time, they learned about Anika. Mm-hmm. And they said, wow, you guys should do this together. And they said, you know what? And you should do a book to go with the course. And so that is how it all came together with the book.
Can you talk about actually how the book is structured? Like, so people know, like, is this going to help me teach kids? Is this giving me a background on, like, what is your goal of the book and how it's structured between you and Anika writing your separate sections?
Sure. So it is meant, and I love the way that you talked about it, it's really meant for everyone. It's not only meant for Black readers, not at all. And it is meant to help people who are interested in classical education to understand that classical education is very capacious, that there have been many different peoples and cultures who have used it, and that you can see that in the Black intellectual tradition in particular. And part of the argument that we make, so classical educators talk a lot about cultivating truth, goodness, and beauty. Mm-hmm. And so part of the argument that we make is that you have to actually read different voices and experiences if you want to really understand what truth and goodness and beauty are. So, you know, take, for instance, the idea of freedom, which is a very, you know, big concept and idea that many classical educators think is very important. I think is very important. You can't really understand the essence of freedom, I think, without reading many of these Black authors, you know, who have wrestled with this idea of freedom. Mm-hmm. We structure the book. The first part of it I wrote, and then Anika wrote the second part of it. My part of it is divided between truth, goodness, and beauty. So it's three chapters, and I'm looking at how reading the Black intellectual tradition helps you to better understand and grapple with the idea of truth, with the idea of beauty, and with the idea of goodness, with these exemplars. And then Anika's part of the book focuses mainly on Anna Julia Cooper, who's an extraordinary Black woman of the 19th century, although she lived well into the 20th century also, looking at her as an exemplar of classical education. So it will give you kind of a philosophical introduction to the idea of classical education and to looking at how these writers of the Black intellectual tradition really enrich our understanding of what it means to pursue truth, goodness, and beauty in the way we do our education.
Is it normally received well by all kinds of people, or do you find that it's mostly Black people that are interested in picking, or maybe even the reverse, like white people who are very concerned, you know, it's very in vogue to be like, we're diverse. So maybe like white moms are desperate for this book. What's been the reception?
It really depends. So I'd say there's been good reception amongst many different kinds of people. On the other hand, I would say it is not the case that Black people have been the most receptive to the work that we're doing.
Mm, that's unfortunate.
Which may not come as a shock to you. Yeah. I don't know. But Anika and I have done, you know, different kinds of events promoting the book and promoting the work. I'd say the most difficult and challenging presentation we had was in front of a predominantly Black audience. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, talk about the book, the concepts, classical education, and then we underwent, gosh, it felt like at least an hour. I don't know how long it actually was, of the most intense interrogation you could imagine.
Really?
Yes. And it was really kind of all about, I think, to get to see, like, were we trying to whitewash Black students? You know, like, what was our actual agenda? What were we? And the thing that's so crazy about it is part of what we are showing, I think, in that book, is that it was not extraordinary to have a classical education if you were Black,
right,
until the 20th century. Because that's just what education was.
Yeah.
It already was classical. We only call it classical now because we're contrasting it with the last 100 or so years, right, of progressive education. So anyway, we went through this. I mean, it really did feel like an interrogation, Connie. And so
I could see that if people just didn't know, if they're like, these Black ladies are coming and they're giving, mm-hmm, they're all about classical education, and in their mind, that's archaic, like white dudes, and we want to hear from other people. But I would think that, like, once you gave your presentation, your book is all about Black people. Like, you say what your goals are. You've said it many, many times in this interview, truth, goodness, you know, creating beautiful human beings. I mean, what is there? How is that white? I mean, that's insulting to say that that's whitewashing.
So they didn't come out and say it was whitewashing, but that was just kind of the feeling I was getting. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is that once we finished, they came up to us and said, wow, you know, that was so good. Like, we think what you're doing is great. We think this could be good for our students. So it seemed like whatever test it was, we passed
okay,
it.
Okay.
But I think the initial response was suspicion.
Hmm.
The initial response was really, who are they? Where are they coming from? What's the real agenda here? So, you know, it was just suspicion. And after the grilling, I guess they liked what we had to say.
Okay.
But that's, you know, but I wouldn't say that's the normal response,
okay,
you know?
Okay. Do you know if anybody's, because after I read your book, I was like, okay, now I want this from every ethnic group. Like, where's the Chinese, mm-hmm, version of this? Where's the Native American? Mm-hmm. Where's the Jewish, you know, do you know if people working on this and other, maybe writing a similar book or something, but focused on other classical thinkers and other ethnic groups?
So I do know, I don't know about a book necessarily, but I do know that there's increasing interest in the Hispanic community and you know, kind of thinking about great books education in Hispanic communities. And so I think there's more coming together there. In the curriculum writing that we do in Yonsa, we are pretty careful not to only highlight, you know, Black history and culture, mm-hmm. but to also, for instance, we do a lot of art study. Mm-hmm. And so we will have, you know, Hispanic artists, African-American, European, yeah. you know, we try to really kind of have a group. And then for Asian, I would say there's increased interest in, you know, various kinds of East Asian classics. Mm-hmm. And for there, you actually do have some pretty solid resources. Yeah. So for instance, St. John's College has a whole degree in Eastern classics. Mm-hmm. You know, so there I actually think there's probably more right. already together because there's already such a clear, you know, kind of in the Chinese tradition, right. there's already mm-hmm. a very robust yes. classical tradition that's already there. So,
okay. And you talk about molding different cultures and the way education looks different. And in the book, you talk about the emphasis in classical education on written word versus, and then you contrast that with kind of oral teaching and how that is more of the African tradition, right? And that there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's a great tradition, right? And a lot of knowledge and wisdom was passed generation to generation that way. Do you get people, do you think that's a weakness of a lot of current classical education curriculums, that they are all about like written word and not oral, and then you use like kind of the African tradition as proof that orally teaching things can be just as powerful?
Yeah, so I was very, very careful about this in the introduction, and so thanks for bringing that up. And part of the reason that I emphasize that is that actually in some of the, you know, the Greek texts are at the core of the Western classical tradition. And I think there's been a bit of amnesia of the fact that was largely an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, like it wasn't like you had the schoolboys in ancient Greece, you know, sitting down with books of Homer, right? It was much more an oral tradition, a poetic, a recited tradition. And so in some ways, by studying the Black tradition, where it's not that all of the Black tradition is oral, but there's a lot that is oral. And by studying that tradition, I think you also get a look into what that older Greek tradition might have been like. Mm. And it's for that reason, in one of our curriculums, we actually pair the Iliad with the reading of the Legend of Sundiata from Mali. Mm. And we pair them because they're both epics of war. And it's a really fascinating, you can see similar kinds of themes and overlap in the two of them. And they're both coming out of this oral tradition. They're hundreds of years apart, but they're both coming out of this oral tradition and looking at similar kinds of themes of courage and bravery and cowardice and so on. So I do think it is important to think about oral traditions, to think about poetry, as well as visual traditions. And the other reason is that, I mean, written texts are wonderful and important, mm-hmm. but I also think visual texts are important. So throughout the book, I use Adinkra symbols, which come out of the Akan of West Africa. And it's this really beautiful system of visual information. So there are these kind of beautiful visual symbols that symbol is accompanied by a saying or a proverb. So when you see that symbol, it stands in for the saying or proverb. Mm-hmm. So for instance, the logo for Nyansa classical community, if you look at it, it's an Adinkra symbol. And the saying that goes with it is, the one who does not know can know from learning. So just by seeing that symbol, it communicates that idea. Similar to the Sankofa symbol, which many people are accustomed to seeing. Many African-American communities will use that. It's a bird looking backward, and it's the idea of go back and get it, or kind of learn from the past, right? So I embed those throughout my chapters as well to show and to share ideas visually. So I think all of that has a place, because as we're trying to understand the best of various traditions and what constitutes the classical tradition, I think those visual and oral components are part of that. And it would be a mistake to only look at the textual.
Yeah, I totally agree. One other point of your book that I wanted to ask you about is you've kind of already talked about this, right? You said, if we're studying freedom and we want to understand freedom, like, it's difficult to do that, especially from an American historical context, to not be listening to folks who dealt with it. And I think everybody understands that, like, Black people have a relationship with freedom and a struggle with freedom in America that no other group really has, specifically in America. And you also talk about in the book how, you know, Black writers have something to teach us about despair that other writers may not. And I think you're kind of getting at the same thing. I could see moms who aren't, like, racist. They're not necessarily against having, you know, featuring Black thinkers or whatever, but they have their curriculum and it maybe has, you know, it maybe features Black people, maybe it doesn't, but they're like, you know what, I don't, lots of humans know what despair is, you know, can teach us about despair and even freedom to an extent, although the freedom experience is different for Black Americans. What would you say to those moms that are like, hey, I don't take issue with anything that you're doing, but I don't see it as like a necessity or something that I need to be super focused on bringing in these other diverse thinkers into what we're already doing in our home?
Hmm. Yeah. So if we're speaking in an American context, which I assume we are for the most part, I would say that to separate a classical education from the place where you live is a mistake, mm-hmm. because we are embodied beings who are shaped by history, right? You're not just like a floating spirit out there, right? And so to make any sense of who you are and who your children are, you need to root that in the reality of the history of the particular place that has shaped you. And so if you're going to say, well, we can study truth, goodness, and beauty and, you know, understandings of freedom and how to triumph in despair by studying anyone's story, well, I mean, you could, right? I mean, you could read Chinese literature. The Russians are really good for all this, right? You could just study Russian literature and they've got it beat, mm-hmm. you know, with despair and trauma and, you know, like, and they do it very beautifully. I will say, I love Russian literature. I think you should still read Russian literature, but it would be odd to me to get all of that through Russian literature, or some other literature and not touch on the history here mm-hmm. in the United States. And, you know, think about the thing is too, is that much as we would like to be able to say we can just all live together fine, these issues of race and our troubled racial history just somehow keep coming up. You know, like you're going along your way and you think you're going to be fine, and then something pops up again. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and you're like, gosh, why are we still dealing with this right now?
Yeah,
and I think part of the reason we're still dealing with it is we haven't really adequately tried to understand it. And so if you're just going to say, well, we don't really need to read or think about that, I think that's a problem. And I think we've been struggling with this idea of the American project, right? You know, this has been, especially in the news since the publication of the 1619 Project, mm-hmm. right? And that's just, you know, all kind of controversies and struggles over it, right? And this idea of the American project is very important to me. And I just think, you know, we've developed this almost kind of culture war over now the teaching of history yes. over this. And part of what I would say we should do and why this book and approaches similar to it are so important is, and I've talked to many, you know, audiences, parents, K-12 educators about this. Part of the problem is that we have this kind of polarizing vision of what the American Project is. But when you read Phyllis Wheatley, you know, who is in the book, when you read about her and her history, her letter exchange with George Washington, you know, who was so impressed with her, she is this poet of the revolution, of freedom, of justice. You know, she's there in the 18th century, literally down the street from the Boston Massacre in Boston, mm-hmm. writing about this, you know, like on the front lines. You know, of course, you have Crispus Attucks, who was there at the Boston Massacre. Like, the participation of Black people at the founding of this American project is so important to remember. It's not like we were there as passive victims on the sidelines, right? we were there as part of making the history. And I think people of every background need to know that and to study it. And so in that sense, the parent that you're talking about who might say, well, you know, we're not a Black household and, you know, we can read the Russians to understand tragedy and whatever. It's like, but you're American, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're interested in ideas of freedom and justice and equality and the American project. So you need to be studying this history, this and the Black intellectual tradition as well.
Yes. Yep. Preach it. And I have one more question for you before we get into the speed round here. I live in Northern Idaho, which I sometimes jokingly refer to as like the homeschool capital of America. I don't know that if it is, but there's a lot of people that homeschool here and a lot of amazing co-ops and schools and stuff too. We got everything. We got Waldorf, we got Montessori, we got classical schools. We got it all here. And it, which is really amazing for a small, you know, this isn't a big urban area at all, but people just take it, educating their children really seriously, which is a blessing. And there is a school that has recently popped up that is, they claim to be a classical education school, but they're secular. And so I'm wondering about your thoughts. You've mentioned that you're Christian, about where God is in all of this. And you have a beautiful quote in the book that I'm just going to say now. When the foundations of Christian teaching are well established within us, we are able to read widely and deeply from a variety of traditions and viewpoints, learn from them, and come back to our own tradition fortified, able to see anew the invaluable insights and strengths of that tradition. And truth, beauty, virtue, all those things, I would argue as a Christian myself, you can't know truth without knowing God. So do you make the claim that you can effectively have a classical education outside of Christ? Do you make a play for secular parents? How do you toe that line?
Oh, you want to end with the easy question. That's great. Wow. Okay. So how do I say this? So I am going to say I do personally think it's difficult to have a conception of truth without the divine. It's hard for me to see that. Because when you have no kind of transcendent vision, it's hard to know what you're aiming toward. Yeah. Now, that said, I don't think that necessarily means that you can't have a classical education if you're not Christian. Because I do think it's possible to, you know, pursue to the best of your ability, you know, using your reason, what seems to be true, good, and beautiful. And, you know, this is an interesting one, right? Because if you don't have a universal standard that you're aiming toward, you know, what could that be? And I'm just going to say that I believe that, and I think there are enough secular folks who also believe that there's something in human beings, you could call it reason, you know, I don't know what else you want to call it, that is going to help us to understand that some kinds of things and some kinds of behaviors are better than others, and mm-hmm. some paths to pursue are better than others. One of the books that I think does this really well is C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, where what he argues, and yes, he's a Christian, however, in that particular book, he is not arguing only for a Christian perspective. What he's saying is that there are many wisdom traditions. There's Buddhism, you know, there's Islam, there's Christianity, there's Judaism. There are many different kinds. And these traditions, yes, they differ in some ways, but there's a remarkable convergence mm-hmm. amongst them in terms of what makes for a good person, right? You know, what makes for a healthy community. And so what I think is the brilliance of what he does, and this would, I would kind of just cheat and say my answer is Lewis's answer,
okay.
Is that I think we can reason together, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we have a whole deep well of human history that even though we differ quite a lot, you know, those traditions and what it means to be a good and wise person, there's more overlap than there is difference. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean that I think, oh, all traditions are equally the same. Mm-hmm. No, I don't. You can't say that if you're a Christian. There are certain truths that you do take to be uniquely important when you're coming from a Christian tradition. But there, you know, even the Christian tradition says, you know, there are things in other people in non-Christian cultures that are good,
right,
and true and beautiful, mm-hmm, right? And the quote that you read, what I was saying there is you do need some kind of filtering system to kind of extract that and to know what is true, good, and beautiful in whatever you're reading or seeing, even if it's not coming from a Christian tradition. You don't just dismiss a people and a culture because they're not Christian, but you do come to it with some foundational understandings, and you're looking at, okay, here's what I already know about what's true, good, and beautiful. Oh, and I see this thing in this culture that is also true, good, and beautiful. Mm-hmm. So I think it's possible in a secular context. I think people do have reason. I think to not say so would be to despair at the human condition.
You said that was a hard question, but you just answered that so beautifully. That's like just a great way to end the podcast before we go into these 10 speed round questions. Our listeners know we end every podcast this way. They're fun questions. The goal is for you to answer them quickly, but I mean, let's be honest, half of our guests sometimes go on a tangent with one of the questions, so that's totally fine. We want to hear your thoughts. Don't like rush just because you're like, it's a speed round, I got to be fast. And then after that, you can finish us off with your closing thoughts, whatever you want to get off your chest before we sign off. Are you ready for your 10 questions?
I hope so.
Question number one, is naming a sports team the Redskins wrong?
I think it is wrong today. I think in the context of all that we know about our tortured history, that we can do better than that. And I think it reduces a people to, you know, a physical mark that is pretty dehumanizing.
Fair enough.
So I think we can do better today.
MLK or Malcolm X?
Oh, that doesn't seem fair. Okay. So in terms of political leadership or?
There's nothing more to the question. That's it.
Okay. So I will answer it then in my own way in terms of which has been more influential in my thinking.
Okay.
How about that? So I would say that MLK has been more influential in my thinking. In fact, he is in one of the chapters, yep, in the book. So I've just spent a lot of time thinking about MLK.
Okay, fair enough. What is your favorite city?
Oh, good grief.
I thought I knew the answer to this one.
That's a hard one, but I'll have to go with New Orleans.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll go with New Orleans.
Should churches, including mosques, synagogues, etc., remain tax exempt?
Absolutely.
Should the United States keep daylight savings time?
No, it is against what it means to be an enfleshed human being. It throws everything off. We need to get off of it.
You're here. Whose stand-up do you prefer, Eddie Murphy or Chris Rock?
Gosh. Chris Rock.
Is there a difference between being happy and being joyful?
Wow. Yeah, I'm teaching courses that are dealing with this question of what is happiness. So this is a fun one. That's a hard one to answer because happiness has a different connotation now than it did centuries ago.
Mm. Ooh, I'd love to take your class. Wow.
Can you ask the question again?
Is there a difference between being happy and being joyful?
Okay. Oh, goodness. This is really hard for me to answer because I know the current cultural connotation of what it means to be happy, and I'm just contrasting it with all the reading that I've been doing on it. Given the current understanding and connotation of what happy means, there is a difference between being happy and joyful, I would say. I'd say if I were answering based on what people think of it, joyful, to be joy-filled in particular, would be something that's more abiding. Mm-hmm. and longer lasting, and to be happy would be more fleeting. But I'm answering that in terms of our current cultural understanding of it and not in terms of the longer tradition of asking that question.
Okay. Who is the most underrated Black intellectual?
Living or dead?
Anybody.
Any.
You could do a living and a dead version if you want, if it's too hard to pick.
It's most underrated. Okay. I'm going to slightly change it from underrated to maybe not getting as much attention as I think they should get.
Okay.
And I would say it's Danielle Allen at Harvard, because she is extraordinary. She's so smart. I had the privilege of doing some work with her. She recently ran for governor of Massachusetts.
We love her. And when I look at,
So when I think about all the Black intellectuals and pundits that get airtime, and I'm just, it's devastating to me that that is, you know, that you could have someone as incredible as she is. And I feel like I don't see her everywhere. I don't see people referring to her and her work. And I just think we would be so much better off if we had much more of her voice recognized.
Yeah, it is. It's a shame. I agree with you. Are golfers athletes?
Yes.
And your 10th question is, should we tear down statues of slaveholders?
Wow. So you got me since I'm at the University of Virginia. I have to answer this very, very carefully. I think it depends on the slave owner. And I think it depends on, you know, this is one where I say it's not a one dimensional, you know, one size fits all, just tear every slave owner statue down. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have to say, no, I don't think we should automatically tear them all down. But, you know, I'm not real partial to John C. Calhoun. I don't feel like there's just so much redeeming about him, for instance, you know, that we have to really keep him in rotation. But I do think that there is something that's redeeming about many others, including Thomas Jefferson.
Yep. All right. Fair enough. You got through it. Those are your 10 questions. And it is completely random. I have a list of over 50 questions and I literally do a random number generator. And you just got some of these questions were just so perfect for you, which is, that's God for you. That's what I say. Do you have any closing thoughts for us?
My only closing thought is that I just love what you're doing.
Oh,
I really love what you're doing. I've been listening to the podcast and, I love the whole thing. You know, I think it's so needed. I think for anyone who has grown up being Black, especially in the US, which is my experience, who hasn't fit, you know, kind of like, I don't know if it's stereotypes or mainstream expectations of what it means to be Black, we thank you very much, you know, for acknowledging that, yeah, we are here, and there doesn't have to be one particular way of being Black. And I just think we need more of that.
Exactly. Well, thank you for those kind words. We're a big fan of yours. We'll be linking to your website and the book and all that kind of thing. And like everybody that comes on, obviously, I think they have great stuff to say, or else I wouldn't have them on. But I really think like your book should be required reading for anybody, especially if they have children still that are still being educated.
That's so nice of you.
So thank you so much for coming on, and we hope that we maintain a relationship for a long time to come.
Thank you, Connie.
The number you have dialed.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.